Purim 5766. Tonight we read the Megillah, and the objective of our class today is to understand what is our avoda, in other words, our service. What are we meant to be accomplishing by hearing the Megillah? What thoughts should we have in mind when we hear the Megillah? What should we be achieving in a level of ruchnius from the reading of the Megillah? It's more than just the story of the events of Purim. And what purpose the Megillah actually serves is discussed in the Gemara. The sheets in front of you in Maseches Megillah, Daf Dalet, Amud Beis. The Gemara explains what is the chiyuv of reading the Megillah, and in the proof text that the Gemara brings to defend this chiyuv of when and how you read the Megillah, you can see what the purpose of the Megillah is. Now, these ideas that we're starting with, Heshi, my husband's uncle, Rav Michal Sharkun, has explained, they come from Rav Yosher Ber Soloveitchik, and he has included them in his Sefer Hararei Kedem. And so this is Rav Yosher Ber's understanding of the discussion here in the Gemara, and how it sheds light on the purpose of the reading of the Megillah. So, Amar Rav Yeshua ben Levi. Rav Yeshua ben Levi said, "Chayev Adam Likros es haMegillah baLaila uShlishnoso bayom." This is the ruling that a person is obligated to read the Megillah on the night of Purim and repeat it on the day of Purim. The proof text here is Elokai Ekra Yomam Velo Sane Velaila Velo Domiali. Hashem, my God, I will call to you in the daytime and you do not answer me, and by night there is still no respite for me, no quietness, no quiet time for me. I'm continuously calling out again and again to you, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. So, starting here, this is the basis for the halacha that we read the Megillah at night and in the daytime. However, according to this proof text, which comes from Tehillim Chaf Beis, and that, of course, is the Tehillim, the Mizmor, Ayeles HaShachar, which is a reference to Esther, right? It's about Hester Panim. This proof text shows us that the Megillah is similar to what the Tehillim is saying, a calling out to Hashem by night and by day and again and again and again. And Rashi here on the side says, we repeat it again in the morning, Zecher Lanes, as a way to recall the miracle, Shayuzoakim B'yamei Tzarasam Yom V'layla, that they were calling out and crying, pleading, davening in the days of their tzaros, day and night. So the Tehillim is about constant tefillah and prayer, and that is why we read the Megillah night and day. So according to this, what is the Megillah? What are our thoughts when we hear the Megillah? The Megillah is a tefillah. It's a prayer. It's like the crying we do when we are in danger and we need a salvation from Hashem and we're crying out of desperation and out of fear with tshuva, asking for a kapara, for forgiveness, so that Hashem will eliminate this decree for our destruction, personal, national. That's what the Megillah is. It's a form of tefillah. That's how we start out this Gemara. However, the Gemara continues and tells you that the students who heard this ruling understood it to mean that one is obligated to read the Megillah at night and learn its Mishnayos during the day, to learn the story of Purim from Maseches Megillah in the daytime, not to read it again at night. In other words, the Megillah at night serves the purpose of perhaps telling us the story or even of tefillah, but the repetition during the day is not a tefillah. It's learning, it's Talmud Torah. And if you look in the Rashi here, he says, "B'mizmar l'manatzeach al ayelas ha-shachar, hu shenema al Esther." This is the source for the ruling that we call out day and night. And if you go further, you see that the students understood from this that they should learn it Rashi says, Bnei HaYeshiva Shashamu Shmuazu B'Lashon HaKodesh, they heard this ruling in Lashon HaKodesh, and Lashon HaKodesh says, Lashnosa Bayom, to repeat it in the day. Hayasvurin, they assumed that this meant, that it meant to repeat it, like when we say Lashnosa, Lashon Shona Mishnah, when a person says he's repeating his Mishnah. He's when a person learns and lomed vishone, he learns and goes over it another time. It's also called lishnoso, not to repeat it, just do it again, as in sheni, double, but to review it and repeat it the next day, and to learn it as in learning Mishnah. Okay, to repeat it in terms of Talmud Torah. So from here you see, and the Talmidim were wrong. We don't paskin like this. But what the Talmidim thought it was that the Megillah was not just Tefillah. The Megillah was a form of Talmud Torah. Reading the Megillah during the day was a form of learning Torah. It was a chiyuv, they felt, to study on this day. This day would be dedicated not just to tshuva, but to studying Torah. Furthermore, as we go on in the Gemara, Gemara goes on, we'll read in English, it has been explained to me personally by Rav Chiya Bar Abba that what Rav Yeshua ben Levi meant that his students were wrong, one has to repeat the Megillah, and he brings a proof for that. Furthermore, the ruling of Rav Yeshua ben Levi was stated also by a different Amora. Rav Chelbo said in the name of Ula from Biri, Chayev Adam Likros Osa Megillah Balayla Ulishnoso Bayom, for another reason. The reason we do it twice is for this reason, Shenemar, as it says, Laman yizamercha kavod v'lo yidom Hashem elokai li'olam odeka, which means so that my soul, we spoke last week about how the soul is kavod, so that my soul might sing to you and never be stilled, Hashem, my God, forever will I continuously thank you. So according to this proof text, that the reason we read the Megillah at night and again in the morning is to remind us that as we praise Hashem continuously, without end, so the Megillah therefore becomes a form of Hoda'ah or Hallel. So we have three possibilities. We have three aspects to the Megillah and to the Day of Purim. We have it that it's a form of Tefillah, or that it's a form of Talmud Torah, or that it's a form of Hoda'ah, of thanks. Now, much of what we learn about Purim will fit into one of these three categories. The day will be seen as either one of these three types of days. Now, think about it. From the Tefillah perspective, Yom Kippur turns into a day similar to Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Look, here are the similarities. On Rosh Hashanah, we know the books are opened and our life hangs in the balance, and perhaps Chas V'Shalom were written in the Sefer HaMavis. But then we have time to do tshuva, and by Yom Kippur, we're written in the Sefer HaChayim. Well, that's very familiar to the Purim story. First letters went out, condemning the Jews to death, Sefer HaMavis, and then after the tshuva and all of that, new letters went out, signed by Mordechai this time, condemning the enemies to death and the Jews to life. And no question about it that as Yom Kippur is a tzom, so we also have a tanis. We fast. We understand. Rashi says the tzara that the Jewish people were in, that they were crying day and night. This becomes a time where we feel like our life, like Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, hangs in the balance, as it has many times in the course of our galus, and we turn to HaKadosh Baruch Hu and we beg for Hashem to have rachmanis and to change the gzar din and to rip up the gzar din. The same type of ideas. And so the element that it's a day of tshuva is very, very strong. And don't forget, and we'll get back to this later, that Purim, Kippurim, obviously there's a connection here. At the same time, in terms of Purim being a day of Talmud Torah, we have another theme running through Purim, which is that whole idea of Kimu v'Kiblu. They re-accepted the Torah. It's like Shavuos now. It's similar to Shavuos. They accepted the Torah, and we'll get back to this, under different conditions, under a new arrangement. But it has a connection to Kabbalah Satorah. Haman was no fool. He picked the month of Adar because Moshe died. He understood that there was a lack of connection. We lost the connection to Moshe who gave us the Torah. So it's a day where our connection to Torah is lost. And we celebrate it by re-accepting Torah. And so there's an argument that it's a day like Shavuos. In terms of a day of Hoda'ah, and singing and thanking Hashem and praising Hashem, it becomes like Pesach. Also, there are many similarities between Pesach and Purim. Here, we went on Pesach from Avdus to Cheirus. Here, we went from people condemned to death, the lowest status, unwanted people. There's a nation that's useless for us, Haman says, to a nation that everybody was revering. Many people started converting afterwards. And so you have also this change of status. And then, of course, the Nisim, great Nisim, Nes Nistar, unlike Pesach, which was Nes Galoy, seems very different in nature, a totally different type of Nisim, but equally great, a total salvation of the people. And so you have parallels to Pesach, wine and wine, one type of wine as it's used on Pesach, very measured, designated, then free-flowing wine on Purim. So you see this is also a parallel. So what we're going to do now is go into each category and try to understand Purim from that perspective. And then we'll see how they all really are part of the one big story. What we have to start with, though, is the idea that when we're dealing with Purim, we're dealing with a very unique yontiv. And it's almost paradoxical. Because on the one hand, Chazal say that all the Yomim Tovim will be batal except for Purim. So it's the greatest. And Chazal say that Purim is the last of the Nisim, like the dawn is the end of the night. Think about that. The night is analogous to the Nisim, the era of miracles, open miracles, starting with Pesach. Purim, which is the last of the miracles, and by the way, this means the last of the written miracles. Hanukkah came later. But Purim is the last Nes to be recorded and canonized as part of our Tanakh. It's Kosov, it's a written miracle. So among the written miracles, this is the dawn. This is the beginning of the new day. This is the future. And the era of Nisim, open miracles, that's the night. What does that mean? What does that mean? So Purim is discussed as the dawn. It's a glimpse of Achris Hayamim. It's the only Yontiv not to be batal. On the one hand, we say that, right? This is the nature of Purim. On the other hand, the way we celebrate Purim, it's the least of the Yom Tovim. It doesn't have the solemnity of Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur, the pomp and ceremony of Pesach. And so what is Purim? It's almost as what it is now. It doesn't really give us a sense of what it will be in the future, what it is described as being. There's a disconnect. And when we understand that, we will begin to understand how it is really a day of tshuva and a day of Torah and a day of hoda'ah all together. It's interesting that today, the way Purim is celebrated, it's possible, unless one is careful, that the day can degenerate into a day that's not the most dignified for some people. And it even is the way that they celebrate it with wine and dressing up and levity could become a day, and unfortunately we see this sometimes, that is, not the most elevated and refined of days. And the question is, how could Purim, as the Chazal are describing as the only yontif to remain, the dawn, the greatest, why does it become like that? How is it that there's this association, with the undignified behavior of perhaps? So when we think about the Nes and the Tzoros they found themselves in, which they were saved from through their tshuva and their tefillah, let's analyze their situation. Let's compare it to Hanukkah. These are the last two Nisim in Jewish history. There's a great difference between Hanukkah and Purim. Purim itself is a Nes that kind of gives us the feeling, on one level, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is never abandoning us. Hinei lo yonam v'lo yishan shomer Yisrael. He won't abandon us. He's watching us. But he lets the Nes play itself out through unappealing ways. Through ways that are kind of like befitting the Jewish people when that's all they deserve and that's where they're at, so that's how the Nes will come through, those type of ways. But it's not the great, glorious Nisim of Hanukkah. Look, you have Esther. She's considered a tzedekes, a religious girl, a righteous girl. She's condemned to marry Achashverosh, enter his harem, and he's equivalent to a you know, Saddam Hussein and his two charming sons, remember them? That's what it was. It's the same place and it's the same thing. And here she is over there in the palace, and she's also condemned. On, she understands that her responsibility is to make herself available to him, in which case she says, "Kasher avadati, avadati, I can't even go back to Mordechai." She sacrifices, and then she has to convince him, if you read the story, that she's really involved with Haman and make him jealous, and Haman's falling on her bed to make him even more jealous after that whole thing. And in the end, Ahasuerus is the king, and she's living in his harem over there, his palace, and they're not in Eretz Yisrael. And we don't say Hallel, and there's no name of Megillah, Hashem in the Megillah. And it's almost like that's it. If that's the level we were on, then that's how the Nace works itself out. But it's more Hollywood than Tanakh, you know? And so sometimes you can begin to understand from this that the Jews really are there's an implied guilt here of the Jewish people that the Nace comes through these type of measure, you know, this type of way. But there is guilt here. Don't forget Koresh, who announced that everyone can return and begin building the base of Megdash, preceded Ahasuerus. Why were they in Shushan at all? Why were they still there? You know, Ahasuerus stopped the building of Koresh, and it was later Daryavesh, the either biological or philosophical descendant of Esther, that renewed the decree that they can continue building the Beis HaMikdash. So there is an implied guilt here, and they're at his party. And, you know, 6 months with beds of, you know, I mean, why, you know, we have words for parties like this. So there's an implied guilt here, no question about it, and therefore we understand that the level the Jews had really descended to in Gullus over there in Bavel, and yet despite it all, when it came to the possibility that they would be annihilated, that Hashem was allowing them to be scared into tshuva, and they rose up and did tshuva, their salvation came. Even from the deepest depths of their own descent into decadence, whatever it was over there, even though Hashem kind of gave the message, look, I don't want to get my hands dirty with this whole scenario, let it work its way out, you know, through whatever it has to be. You know, compared to Hanukkah is a whole different nace. First of all, you have Rabin Biad Ma'atim, you have a glorious victory for the Jewish people. You have the rededication of the Beis HaMikdash. After Purim, there's still no Beis HaMikdash. They're still sitting in Bavel with Ahasuerus. You have Persume Nisa. You have Hallel. We're much prouder of the Hanukkah Nes than we are of the Purim Nes, in a sense. And perhaps this is why the day is celebrated sometimes like this. You know, perhaps. Don't forget, after the Hanukkah Nes, you have the Jewish monarchy is reestablished. You have kings from the Jewish line. You have a much more satisfying end to the story. And yet at the same time, thinking about Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, through the years of Golos and national and personal cycles of life, people have their better moments and their weaker moments. And this teaches us that even in the weaker moments, when we really shouldn't have less to be proud of, you might say, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will listen to tefillah and he will save the Jewish people and save us, and there can be a kapara, and the tefillah works and the crying out works, and Hashem has not abandoned us. And so the aspect of tshuva and tefillah on Yom Kippur, on Purim, is similar to Yom Kippurim, which is the day where we dress in white and we don't eat and we don't drink, and we're like malachim. You know, it's a great comparison between Purim and the story versus Yom Kippur and the holiness. And yet we're saying, on both extremes, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is willing to hear our tshuva and our tefillah. And so on the one hand, the Megillah, when we hear the Megillah, when we concentrate tonight on the Megillah, it is a time of tshuva and tefillah. And this is what Gemara says, we say it twice, because we continuously cry out until Hashem saves us. No question, that's an aspect of the avoda, what a person thinks about when they're leaning or hearing the Megillah tonight and tomorrow. In addition to this, of course, we have what the Talmidim mistakenly understood would be the halacha, which is to learn the Megillah, Maseches Megillah, in the morning, that it's a form of Talmud Torah. Now, though we don't paskin like that, they have a svara. They have an understanding of the day that they are basing their what they think the ruling is on. So what is the relationship now between Talmud Torah and Purim? And so you have the idea of Kimu v'Kiblu. Let's think about this for a while. Going back to what we said, Haman chooses Zion Adar, and there's strange, the Chazal, much of what Chazal say is written, said in riddle form. They do not write in essay form. And so they have these statements that at first glance don't make sense, like the one we said before, which we're going back to, that Purim is the end of the Nisim, like the dawn is the end of the night. We'll get back to that. Here, we're talking about first Kimu v'Kiblu. Kimu v'Kiblu, and so here Chazal say the following. Chazal say that he chose Adar. He chose the month of Adar because this was the month that Moshe Rabbeinu died. However, Chazal say that he didn't know that Moshe Rabbeinu also was born in Zion Adar. Now, why didn't he know this? So my husband, Heshi, explained this idea, and it's quite astonishing. Nobody knew when Moshe was born, remember? Betitz Penehu, she hid him for 3 months. Nobody knew when he was born. When was she unable to continue hiding him? 3 months later, Chazal say when there was so much light, remember the light, that the house was filled with light back there in Shemos, that she had to put him in that little basket she made. What is 3 months? Which day is 3 months after Zion Adar? If you know that 2 months are 29 days and one is 30, Vav Sivan. The day of the giving of the Torah was the day that Moshe could no longer be hidden. What are we saying here? Chazal say that although Haman did not know that he was born on Zion Adar, we know that, and that's why we were saved, because let his birth come and be mechaper for his death. Normally we would think that you say let his death come and be mechaper for his birth, since a person's born, they make a lot of mistakes, so his death is the final kapara. But Chazal say let his birth come and be mechaper for his death. What is this? We're obviously dealing with something here that's profound and secret, something Haman didn't realize, and maybe something we, the Jewish people, didn't realize until the story of Purim, or until the gullus that was surrounding the story of Purim. There obviously is a Moshe who's born and hidden. There's a hidden Moshe. And there's a revealed Moshe, the Moshe that you couldn't hide anymore, the Moshe of Vav Sivan. Let's talk about the revealed Moshe. Who is the revealed Moshe? The revealed Moshe is the Moshe, the famous Moshe. Moshe that did all the 10 Makos, except the last one, of course. That's Aniva Lo Ashaliach, Aniva Lo Malach. Moshe who picked his hand up and the sea split. Moshe who went up on the mountain, and Hashem and Moshe were speaking, and everybody was hearing this happen. Moshe, who's the Chuslaman, came down. Moshe, who went up on the mountain 40 days and 40 nights, and then 80 days, more like a malach than a man. Moshe, whose face shone with karnei or rays of light. Moshe, who went in and heard Hashem speak to him between the kruvim, from between the kruvim on top of the aron. This is the revealed Moshe, Moshe who brought us Torah, amidst great miracles and Giloy Shechina, and with the greatest form of prophecy. Moshe spoke to Hashem by panim al panim, face to face, like somebody speaks to a friend, with calm, alert, awake, unlike all the other Nevi'im who were not in that state when they received Nevuah. This is the revealed Moshe. The Moshe that we have a connection to. The Moshe who we accepted Torah from. When we accepted Torah from Moshe Rabbeinu, because we trusted, because we heard Hashem speaking to Moshe, and we knew that Moshe was reporting accurately the words of Hashem, and the Moshe who offered us the Torah, Hashem, through Moshe, Hashem offered us the Torah, the Moshe presented us the possibility, the option, so to speak, even though we spoke about the fact that it's not really possible, there's an option to receive Torah, but the Moshe was presented to us, would you be a Goy Kadosh and a Mamlechas Konim, who we answered, Nase V'Nishma. That's the revealed Moshe, the Moshe who we received Torah from. And when we receive Torah from that Moshe, we receive Torah, as the Pasuk, the Medrash says, in a state of compulsion. We were compelled. Remember Har Kegigis, the mountain over their heads. That's how we received Torah. So Chazal say that after that, Klal Yisrael had a very strong argument to HaKadosh Baruch Hu in the time of the Golas. They said to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we receive Torah under certain conditions, under conditions of open miracles, of obvious prophecy, of Giloy Shechina, of Moshe Rabbeinu, and Nisim Niglaim. That's how we receive Torah. And we were compelled because of the absolute obvious fact that there was no options. We had no choice anymore. There was almost no Bechira at that point. We were so awed and almost in a sense, not just were they awed, that's such a weak word for what they experienced at that time. But the truth was so evident that they accepted Torah as something. There was no options for them. However, you've destroyed the Beis HaMikdash. We have no more Nevuah. We don't have any prophets. Forget about Moshe. We lost him in the Midbar. But at least we had Nevi'im who continued that Mesorah of prophecy, that style that we had as part of our national character, that we were people that had prophecy amongst us. We've lost that. We have no Kohen. We have no Choshen. We don't hear Hashem speaking to us. There's no Jewish kings. We don't have miracles. That whole arrangement is gone. Now, we didn't necessarily accept Torah under these conditions of what we call Hester Panim. We didn't accept Torah under these conditions. We accepted Torah under Moshe Rabbeinu's conditions. He embodied that whole era, that whole way of life, that whole experience. That's how we accepted Torah. Hama knew Moshe died, which means that their entire connection to that life was gone. And here they were abandoned, he thought, by Hashem. Hashem had hidden his face from them, Hester Panim. Hashem had turned away from them. And so the connection was lost. Maybe we thought that too. That's what Chazal say. We had a very strong argument. But what we came to learn, and what's at the core of the Kimuva Kiblu, the re-accepting of the Torah, is we came to learn through the Purim story, and with love, not with Har Kegigis, a mountain over their head, we came to know that under these conditions, without any of the trappings, without the Beis HaMikdash and the prophets and the miracles and the karbanos that bring us kapara and the Kohen Gadol and the Big Day Kohuna and the whole thing, without any of the trappings, we still can maintain a connection to Moshe Rabbeinu, his Torah alone, the word, the written word and the spoken word. That's it. That's all we have left. That's the hidden Moshe, the revealed Moshe of Matan Torah. He died on Zion Adar, but that was the one who was born, you might say, on Vav Sivan. But the Moshe was born on Zion Adar, who nobody knew about. That secret connection to Moshe. The fact that we can be Moshe's Talmidim without any of the trappings. The fact that we're not dependent on that whole lifestyle to keep the Torah and to be connected to Moshe, through Moshe, to Hashem. That was the secret. That was the secret. And that's why Rashi says, let his birth come and be mechaper for his death. What we're saying is the death of Moshe philosophically means our loss of all of those levels that we associate with Moshe Rabbeinu at the Chorban, the Golus. That's the eventual, the final death of Moshe. Really, we lost Moshe in the Midbar. Whose fault was that? Shimun HaMorim, the Jewish people complained. Moshe, the whole story with Mei Meriva hitting the rock, Moshe remained in the Midbar. He couldn't accompany the Jews in Eretz Yisrael. But still, we said in Eretz Yisrael, they had still remnants. They had still a lot that was similar to the era of the Midbar, a lot more than we have. And that was completely lost by the Chorban. So the Jewish people understood by Purim that we are not dependent on the revealed Moshe and that whole way of life and all of the miraculous things that were always present. There is Moshe Rabbeinu, who we're still connected to. Now Rambam refers to Moshe in two different ways. Moshe Rabban shall call Hanaviim, that's the revealed Moshe. The Vav Sivan Moshe, and Moshe Rabbeinu, our teacher. That's the hidden Moshe, and that connection is the secret to our continued existence. And under the conditions of Golos, without the trappings, the Neis Nister, that's when Klal Yisrael willingly, not Har Kegigis, and notice this, my grandfather points out, what is a gigis that everyone talks about? It's a barrel that you normally store wine. On the first time Matan Torah, there was a barrel of, like, so to speak, wine over their heads, right? But a barrel of wine, that's a reference to Purim. That's a reference to Purim, where wine becomes important, which we'll get into. So here they re-accept the Torah with love and with happiness, seeing that Hashem has not abandoned us, that it's a different arrangement, but Hashem is still with us. Maneuvering things. It's not the same type of nisim like we were used to, but it doesn't mean Hashem has left us. Hashem is not sleeping. And so we re-accept the Torah under these conditions willingly and happily, lovingly. That's kimu v'kiblu. They re-accepted it. And that's why there is an aspect of Purim, which is like Shavuos, Kabbalah Satorah, through joy and thanksgiving. And so when we learn the Megillah and we hear the story of Purim and during the day of Purim, that too becomes part of our avoda in our heads on Purim. We are happily accepting the Torah once more, not by force, not with open miracles, not with that whole type of lifestyle that compelled one to accept the Torah, but free willingly, voluntarily accepting the Torah. And the reason we were so happy to accept the Torah is because of the Neis, because we saw an amazing Neis. And here we get into the comparison between Purim and Pesach. Again, we said, perhaps it's a day of Hoda'ah, of thanking Hashem, and the Megillah really does play the role of Hallel on Purim. Let's talk about Purim and Pesach and compare the Nisim. And here we get back to what we said, that Purim is the end of Nisim, like the dawn is the end of the night. As if Nisim is the nighttime. So, what's between Purim and Pesach? First of all, Purim is the first month of the Jewish year, and I'm sorry, Pesach is the first month, and Purim is the last. So that means that it's not just a story of the year, the cycle of the year, but what it represents for us is that Pesach is the beginning of Jewish history, and Purim is the end. It's the end of the night. It's the beginning of the dawn. It's a glimpse at Achris Hayamim. It's the whole story of Jewish history is contained between the bookends of Pesach and Purim. Notice that on Pesach and Purim, both ways of celebrating involve wine, but in a very different form. On Pesach, the wine is measured, very designated, certain parts in the Haggadah. Purim, it's free-flowing, it's Adalo Yada. Okay, we'll come back to this. But if one had to compare Pesach and Purim, it's almost laughable. There is no comparison. Pesach with the Nisim and Purim, as we said before, yes, in the end things worked out right, but where were the Nisim? Where exactly were the Nisim in Purim? Look, Pesach, Hashem had no regard for the laws of nature. Turned the river to blood and blew in the locusts and blocked out the sun and sent the wild animals out of the forests and jungles right into the cities and etc., etc. Not only did Hashem interfere with nature, Hashem went so far as to do something which is almost never happens. Hashem interfered with human nature, with free choice. It says a pshat in the pasuk, Hashem hardened Paro's heart. Why? Rambam says it was his punishment, but no question about it. That's almost untouchable. Hashem almost never involves himself with free choice, because free choice is the tzelem Elokim. It's what makes us God-like. Right? If the most God-like thing, so to speak, about God is his freedom to do whatever he wants without anyone stopping him, so for a human to be totally free is what makes us like Hashem, and to take that ability away, we're a bunch of robots, and then you start dealing with problems. Well, how do you punish someone if they had no free choice anyway? Just on the side, I remember I told you, my grandfather of Schwab explains that Paro deserved to be punished, although he could not possibly fulfill what Hashem wanted, which was to listen to Moshe. Hashem had hardened his heart, and yet he was punished. Paro did, that was Mida Keneged Mida. He made them gather the straw and make the bricks, and he knew they couldn't possibly do it all in one day. It was physically impossible, and then he punished them for not being able to do it. Mida Keneged Mida, he was also incapable of listening and was punished for not listening. In any case, Hashem interferes with Bechira Chafshas, free choice. That is very unusual. In the Purim story, what exactly does Hashem do? Does he turn any rivers to blood? Does he interfere with Teva? No. Does he interfere with human beings' free choice? Think about it carefully. The most you can say is that he made Esther find chen. He was attracted to her. He found her charming and appealing. But that's not exactly a nace galoy, and many people are found appealing in other people's eyes, find themselves appealing, or people have find other people full of chen. You want to say that he allowed Mordechai to overhear Bigzhan and Teresh? Could be, right? Could be, but he didn't compel Mordechai to go relay this information to Achashverosh. Mordechai could have, and maybe many would have, said, you know what, I don't like Achashverosh. He's not our friend. Let him poison him. What do I care? He didn't have to save Achashverosh. That was his choice. What exactly did Hashem do on Purim? This is the story. We know it all worked out, but at every step along the way, it seems like people made their own choices. Look, it was Haman's choice to remove Vashti, right? No question about it. In fact, they call him there Mimuchan, which comes from the word Muchan, he was ready. When you're faced with a crisis, a problem, and you need to come up with a solution, normally you got to think about it. Haman was on the spot. He had an answer. He was prepared, which means he already, from early on, was deviously figuring out ways to get himself into the throne. And the most important thing to do first was to get rid of Vashti, because she was really the heiress to the throne legitimately. Ahasuerus was just a warlord that was very powerful and rich who married her. So he was Mumuchan. He had a long-standing plan that preceded this whole story for himself. And then remember what he said to Ahasuerus? And we can't really appreciate those words unless we go back to Shmuel and Shaul and Agag. When Shmuel was upset at Shaul for not killing Agag, he says, that's it, you've lost the kingdom. I told you to kill out everyone in Amalek. So he says to Shaul at the time, I'm going to take away your malchus and I'm going to give it to Lereacha Hatov Mimecha, to your friend who's better than you. And he takes the malchus away from Shaul, gives it to David. 600 or so years later, Haman says to Ahasuerus, let's take the malchus away from Vashti. Haman's the grandson of Agag. And he says, let's give it to Lereusa Hatova Mimena, to her friend who's better than her. And Haman hands the malchus back to Esther, the granddaughter of Shaul, to finish the job. So in case you think that people don't get a second chance, this is the aspect of the tshuva of the Megillah, the Yom Kippur aspect, the fact that there's always a chance. And this explains what Mordechai said to Esther. He said, Im ha-charesh ta-charishi, if you don't, you know, play out your role, you don't go to him, you don't plead for the Jews, I'm not afraid. Revach v'atzala yamad la-yehud l'mimakam acher. The Jews are going to be saved some other way. But what's at stake here? At u'beis avich tovedu, you and your father's house will be lost. What's at stake is your legacy, your father, grandfather Shaul's legacy. Here's your chance. That's what's your job. So this is part of the idea that Hashem always gives us another chance. But you see that Haman, his own decisions destroyed him. You know, he builds the gallows. What's happening on Purim is the following, and it's radically different than Pesach. But now our question is, which is greater? Pesach, Hashem bursts out of the heavens, so to speak, with these shocking, you know, miracles, and compels people to obey. Whether they want to or not, by the time you get through the Pesach miracles, people are dumbfounded and they say, I have no choice. So they accept Hashem's malchus, they accept Hashem's will, they accept what's emes and what's sheker, what's tov and what's ra, because they're compelled from the outside and they have they're absolutely speechless and motionless and they have no options. What happens on Purim is Hashem doesn't have to do anything. What happens on Purim is the Rasha himself gives in, because everything he tries to do comes back to destroy only himself. He's not compelled to recognize Hashem is the Melech because Hashem forces him for some big shocking miracles. He becomes to recognize that Hashem is the Melech and Hashem's will stand, Rabbas Machshavas Belevish, Be'atas Hashem Yisakum, because he personally has tried to go against the will of Hashem and has only succeeded in destroying himself. Eventually, when you spin your wheels and try, and it only comes back to destroy you, you give in because you've learned the lesson experientially that the world is going to run the way Hashem wants it to run. It's a world of tzaddik v'tovlo, rasha v'ralo. What a nice world. It's a world where the Rishayim can get up with their rhetoric and their speeches and their meetings and their colleagues, and they can build their weapons, and they can do everything. And in the end, this is Achris Hayamim. We are so confident that the only people who will suffer and be destroyed is themselves. Those are the only people who will suffer. They will destroy themselves. And when you destroy yourself enough times, you give in, and you say, Hashem is a tzaddik and I'm a rasha. Now, that's what we said in the beginning. Pesach is the beginning of Jewish history. Purim is at the end. Purim is the end of Nisim. There will be a time in Achras Hayamim where those big, great Nisim will not be necessary because history, humanity will have learned through their own experiences that to try to eradicate the Jewish people, to try to set up the world on the basis of Sheker, to try to run this world according to their own will, is useless and hopeless, and they will eventually give in. That's Purim. Pesach will transition to Purim. And the Jews will sit confidently and watch them spin their wheels and burn themselves up and hang themselves on their own gallows. This is Achris Hayamim. This is what Chazal mean when they say it's the end of Nisim, like the dawn is the end of the night. Now history has progressed quite a bit since Pesach, the original Pesach, and many nations have tried to destroy us, but they still try, so they haven't learned their lesson yet. Eventually, not just will they learn their lesson that they cannot succeed, eventually part and parcel of the end of days is the offensive war the Jews make on Amalek, which means that we, and this is reserved for Achros Hayamim, for Eretz Yisrael, when there's a Melech and a Beis HaMikdash. It might be there will only be one token Amaleki left on earth at that time. Who knows? You only need one, you know. There was one Hitler and everyone else just followed. But let's say there's one Amaleki. Eventually the Jews go on the offensive. We are not people that take Nekama, but we are told, and that's why there's Purim and Shushan Purim. The first day is defensive fighting, and the second day that Esther asked for is a day to go on the offensive, which is reserved for Achros Hayamim. It's a glimpse into the way things will be in Achros Hayamim. It's a day to go on the offensive against Amalek, when they were already neutralized. Hashem had already given them rest from their enemies, and they now pursued Amalek, their enemies back there in the Purim story, offensively. to establish what's right and what's wrong, and finally set the world up the way it should be. So the question now is, Hester Panim of Purim or the Giloy Panim of Pesach? Really, you might say, Purim, it's the only yontif not to be butel. Really, that's what we are hoping for, a world that Hashem doesn't have to come and break through the heavens and compel people anymore, a world where people will know it automatically. And this perhaps is the secret of the wine, the free-flowing wine compared to the designated wine of Pesach. Pesach represents the infancy of the Jewish people, of humanity's coming into their own. Don't forget the 2,000 years before that were tohu vavohu, chaos. This was the real years of development, and HaKadosh Baruch Hu had broken, you, we might say, into the scene and presented to humanity what his will is, what he wants, how he wants the world, all people to conduct themselves, and Shevet Mitzvot B'nei Noach, Aseres HaDibros, basic structure for the way the world should conduct itself. And when something is new, when you're moving from paganism and all of that, and that survival of the fittest way of thinking, into the structure of the Aseres HaDibros and one God, it's new. So what do you do when something's new? You analyze it, you turn it around and around, you see it from all its sides, you discuss it, Sipur, Haggadah, question, answer. That's the whole energy of the Seder, is the question and the answer and the talking. V'chol ha-marbalus, whoever speaks longer, kol ha-marbalus yech b'yitzias Mitzrayim, ha-reza meshubach, it's considered praiseworthy. The more you discuss it and analyze it and argue it, and the wine comes in a punctuated type of way along the way in the Haggadah to tell us, remind us of our salvation, but also it's very controlled. Gives us insight, but it's very controlled. By the time you get to Purim, free-flowing wine. Ad lo yada. Now what's that? Remember that strange thing, until you don't know the difference between Arur Haman and Baruch Mordechai, you could say Baruch Haman and Arur Mordechai. What is that? What's Chazal saying there? Perhaps this is the secret. It doesn't matter by the time you get to Achras Hayamim, but Purim, that time of Purim. It doesn't matter if the Goyim get up and they're enemies and they make their speeches, Arur Mordechai, and they build their weapons, and Baruch Haman, and etc. It all doesn't matter. We don't have to get up there with das, with knowledge, and make arguments defending that what's right and what's wrong and trying to fight. Let them say whatever they want to say. It doesn't matter, because Purim teaches us tzadik v'tov lo, rasha v'ra lo, only Hashem's will prevail. It doesn't really matter anymore. They'll learn it on their own. It'll come. They'll see. And that's why we have the idea of wine. And notice Rav Huttner points out something very unique, unusual about the bracha we make on wine. With this we end. When you pick a grape off a vine, you're standing next to the vine. You're holding the grape in your hand. You know it comes from the vine. You do not make a Borei Pri HaGafen. You say Borei Pri HaEtz. Years later, many years later, when it doesn't look like a grape and it doesn't taste like a grape, and if you didn't know it came from a grape, you wouldn't even know this drink came, you know, was originally from a grapevine. Then, when it's totally changed, when it seems to have lost its complete connection to its shoresh, we make a Borei Pri HaGafen, which indicates maturity, going, you know, developing, going down the road, further and further, the process. We're not getting further. The Hester Panim doesn't mean we're further from Hashem. The Nisim of Purim, it doesn't mean we're further. It means we've come way back directly to the Shoresh in another form. Things have transitioned, things have changed, things have evolved, and yet we're right back at the Shoresh. And the Shoresh is a world that is set up and conducted according to what's right and what's wrong, that people on their own, through their own choices, will eventually come into this world. Those that refuse to see will not make it into the future. Those that will change perspective, begin to see, reorient, give in, become our supporters, will make it into the future world. And we ourselves will learn the same lesson in greater and greater clarity. And this is the love and the excitement that the Jews experienced on Purim that allowed them to re-accept the Torah and accept the Torah under these conditions. And so it's also a day designated for Hallel and Hoda'ah, our Thanksgiving. These are all of the energies of the day that we keep in mind as we go through the day and thereby elevate the day to something that is befitting of Achras Hayamim. Okay, so it ends here. Have a wonderful Purim, everybody.